are in for a treat, I think. This is probably, I feel, the most important of all the programs, or of all the topics that we have broached so far, probably the most important topic in radical psychiatry, qua psychiatry, namely women's liberation. Now, Hoagy is going to present about it. I just want to give a kind of a background of my own feeling about it. As some of you know, I've been doing psychiatry for years in private practice, and some of the standard type of situations that one encounters in private practice is, first of all, marital unhappiness, and a larger percentage of women than men seeking therapy. Now, as far as, I won't talk about larger percentage of women, that's something that Hoagy's going to discuss, but for years, my approach to unhappy marital couples was totally ignorant of the understanding of the meaning of male oppression or women's liberation and all that. I didn't know anything about it. I was myself brought up as a male chauvinist and thought that that was the way to be. I was singularly unsuccessful in working with couples. I mean, I was as good as everybody else, because what happens is that couples will come in and they're miserable with each other, and then with a little bit of encounter and a little bit of gestalt therapy and a little bit of insight therapy sprinkled in with some other things, the couples began to feel better. Maybe they even got turned on to each other and they had some good sex for a while. And so it could have been easy to just say, well, you know, I'm really very good at this and I can do real well with couples. But the point is that, to be honest, if I had to be honest about it, if I regarded these couples over periods of more than a year or two after the therapy, it wasn't working, because these relationships were kind of revitalized by the three of us, but they would invariably fall apart, at least go back to where they were when they came in. I also ran across the unhappiest of married people I've ever seen, which are people, they're people like, they're suffering the same kind of unhappiness that people who lived in previous centuries who couldn't get divorces, you know, were forced to stay with each other. Only now, they were forced to stay with each other by a series of psychotherapists who would revitalize the relationship for a couple of months, and then it would fall apart, and they'd say, well, let's go to some other guy, maybe let's try gestalt, and he'd do that for 3 months, and then they'd have to go to some other guy, and it kept going like this. And maybe there'd been 10 or 15 years of this constant fanning of what little there was between the two people to kind of make the relationship go. I admitted that I wasn't any good at it after a while, and I was questioning, what was it, you know, what was it that I was doing wrong? Well, I think what I was doing wrong is that I didn't know anything about the oppression of women. I wasn't aware of the fact that the classical marriage situation is absolutely rigged to be a situation where women are oppressed. And if it survives beyond 7 years, it usually goes like this. For the first 7 years, the man oppresses the woman. And for the next 7 years, she gets into an insurgency situation where she pretty much defeats the man. She doesn't defeat him, but she kind of keeps him, you know, in a good guerrilla warfare type situation where nothing really happens. You know, she'll stop having sex and he'll become impotent, and that's just about all there's left of it after 14 years. And that she does by, you know, basically guerrilla techniques. And these techniques are often thought to be oppression of women, of men by women, but that's nonsense, because it's not the same. Men oppress women, and women eventually get even in this kind of a insurgency basis, but not in any way really oppressing men in any kind of a equivalent, an equivalent basis. Okay, well, I think that that's really where it's at. So now when I work with couples, all I want to work with is women's liberation, that is liberating the woman from depression in the relationship. And that sometimes can be done, sometimes the man doesn't want to do it. Occasionally a woman says, I don't want to do that, but that's very rare. It's usually the man who says, yeah, all right. See, a lot of liberal males say, yeah, I have nothing against women's liberation. But when it comes right down to the nitty-gritty, you know, it's not going to be. And that's not surprising because the man, in a context, you know, an average middle-class context, is in a situation where he has to oppress his wife because he has to put out cars for General Motors or papers for the university or whatever. And as he's doing that, and he's being basically exploited by whatever institution he works for, he has to then exploit whoever's around him to keep himself going. And this is kind of the assumption that man puts out for the system, and then the woman is a kind of a battery or a reservoir of energy that he has to draw from in order to keep going. And what he hopes is that she won't run out and, you know, before the menopause. But definitely she will run out then, and you know, that's the way it goes. Okay, so, and I have a very nice little thing here. This is a book by Eric Fromm that has the 1844 manuscripts of Marx, in which Marx turns out really to be a psychologist, at least as far as I can see, at least that, if not other things. But he's definitely a humanist psychologist in these manuscripts. Crude communism that would propose that women are common property of a commune, in a commune, I guess. And when he read it, I didn't really understand what it was all about. I read it several other times, and then reading in a different order from the way Marx wrote it, I think it became clear to me anyway. He says, the relation of man to woman is the most natural relation of human being to human being. In this relationship is sensuously revealed, and what he means by sensuously revealed, I think, is where you can really see it. You can really look at it and see what's going on, sensuously revealed. Reduced to an observable fact, again, something you can look at, the extent to which human nature has become nature for man. In other words, the extent to which man has become truly human, or has really become, his nature has become its most excellent. And to which, and the extent to which nature has become human nature for him. To the extent to which this natural relationship between man and woman has become human nature for him. Okay, I think that's enough. In other words, what Marx is saying is that human nature, the most excellent aspects of it, are most obviously observable, most readily perceived in the man-woman relationship. And he also says, and I was looking for this, but I can't see it. In the relationship with woman, conversely, as the prey and handmaid of communal lust, who's as the, you know, as the slave of communal lust, is expressed the infinite degradation in which man exists for himself, conversely. That is, just as the man and woman relationship expresses the most sublime of human nature, it also can express the most, degraded. And I think that's really true. And I feel that men and women of man, and this may sound to some of the women in women's liberation as a kind of a counter-revolutionary statement about women should always be with men, you know, that women, the relationship with women and woman is not as important. I'm not saying that. If a woman chooses to have another woman as her love object, fine. And the point is that the relationship of woman with man seems to be one in which all of the excellence of humanity can be expressed. And obviously it's not being expressed. Most marriages don't make it, you know. 3 out of 4 marriages go bust in California, and 50% go bust in the United States. I think most of the assumptions in the average marriage are sexist and are male chauvinist. The whole institution is set up for the benefit of producing, you know, for someone else and not for the people involved. Okay, well, this is Hoagy, and she is an excellent woman.
I'd like to say a few things as an introduction. I'm a little bit ill at ease, and I think that the reason I'm ill at ease is I'm ill at ease talking to a mixed group about something that I feel is, well, that as I've worked it out, it's for women who want to help other women get it together. And so the general address is to women. I feel justified in presenting it to a mixed group because this is a class in radical psychiatry, and I feel that the problem of women's liberation touches everybody, I mean both sexes. And possibly a few things I might have to say might help the men, I don't know. The reason I'm struggling with it, and I feel that it's so important, well, a couple of reasons. I feel that it's really needed in the women's liberation movement, a good therapeutic model, rather than just consciousness models, but there are a lot of small groups dealing in awareness, but I feel that, you know, we might be able to, the radical psychiatry people might be able to help by providing group therapy models. And the reason that I feel it's really important is because the majority of the people who come to psychiatrists for help are women because they're oppressed. I mean, that makes sense, I think. To me, it makes sense. If I go through things too fast, I think you should be sympathetic to where my consciousness is at. I have a lot of premises that I've thought through and accepted, and I don't know if I'm, you know, laying them out too fast. And I don't know where different people's heads are at on these issues. So if I go through something too quickly and you're not satisfied, just stop me and I'll go into it a little more. I think that it's vital to both sexes to end sex roles. I think that both men and women will benefit by women becoming complete, whole human beings, not just part of a man or having to fulfill a role that leaves them in some ways inadequate. And I think that men also, because of the sex role thing, are left to a certain degree inadequate, and also pay a price in not living as long and by being without certain alternatives in their lifestyle. And let's see, I have some material, things that I've read that I found very helpful, and I thought that if it doesn't get too boring, I'd start quoting a few things that I think are important. This is an excellent publication, Women's Liberation, Notes from the Second Year, Major Writings from the Radical Feminists. And there's a very good article in here, Women and Her Mind, The Story of Everyday Life by Meredith Tax. And one thing she says here that I think is very important is, men and women are brought up to be like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, with pieces carved out of their cells so they can fit into one another. And this same illustration was done up very nicely in the May issue of the Leviathan, which was a women's issue, and she didn't put a name to it, but it was quite a good piece on men and women and how they try to fit together. And a couple of the things that she said were, a lot of women started out being inside him, getting their satisfaction or their sense of wholeness from his adequacy out there. And also the two halves having to come together to complement each other, and that's the sex role thing. When what she was really striving for and what I'm striving for is coming together as equals. If you so desire to come together with a man, have the option of coming together as an equal. And let's see. So I've been struggling with it. I've been doing a couple of women's groups and trying to think, you know, trying to put things I know from radical psychiatry into a context that'll work for women, women's groups. Basically using the radical psychiatry model and adapting things from Burns TA also. So basically what I started out with is a group with a maximum of 8 women and at least 1 leader. You can have a co-leader or whatever. Meeting for about 2 hours once a week and operating with therapeutic contracts. Well, I'll just briefly explain. A contract is the sentence that expresses what you've come into the group to work on. And it should be brief and use simple words that a child could understand. Be pretty behavioral, something you can see, a change you can see, not just a head trip, because it's a means of knowing if you're working or if you fulfill your contract, and it safeguards the leader of the group from laying a trip on you or extending her value to the group member. Would be an example of a contract like that would be I want to be able to make independent decisions, or I want to have an orgasm, or whatever. There is a certain degree of reporting. I mean, you know, she can't prove that she can have an orgasm in group, but she can report on that. But it is a behavioral thing. And let's see. The main sympathies of the group, the main attitude that the leader brings to it is to overcome women's oppression. I feel that, you know, there are two basic forms of oppression that women deal with, and that's oppression on the outside and oppression that they've internalized. Going back to Meredith Tech, these aren't the best examples that I could find. It's just that I'm kind of pushing it because I think it's such a good article. An example of oppression on the outside is, she's talking about why women are so sensitive to their surroundings. Women have to be hyper aware of their surroundings. To walk down a city street without being tuned in, you're in real danger. Our society is one in which men rape, mug, and murder women whom they don't even know every day. You better keep track of what car is slowing down and of who is walking up behind you. And another thing which I'm sure every woman here has experienced, at least I know I experienced it in my adolescence, is where something happens on the outside and you start to not be okay. You start to not feel right about yourself as a woman. A young woman is walking down a city street. She's excruciatingly aware of her appearance and of the reaction to it, imagined or real, of every person she meets. She walks through a group of construction workers who are eating lunch in a line along the pavement. Her stomach... her stomach tightens with terror and revulsion. Her face becomes contorted into a grimace of self-control and fake unawareness. Her walk and carriage becomes stiff and dehumanized. No matter what they say to her, it will be unbearable. She knows that they will not physically assault her or hurt her. They will not do so. They will only do so metaphorically. What they will do is impinge upon her. They will demand that her thoughts be focused on them. They will use her body with their eyes. They will evaluate her market price. They will comment on her defects or compare them to those of other passersby. They will make her a participant in their fantasies without asking if she is willing. They will make her feel ridiculous or grotesquely sexual or hideously ugly. Above all, they will make her feel a thing. This is what women in their role as women experience every day. I don't feel that I have to go into a lot of examples about it, but I don't know if it's clear to everyone how women are dehumanized and how they get a sense of themselves as not being adequate and being defenseless in a way, having to resort to, you know, subterfuge to survive. And when it's internalized, I think a lot of women are in this place. It's a woman speaking about herself. I am nothing when I am by myself. In myself, I am nothing. I only know that I exist because I am needed by someone who is real, my husband and by my children. My husband goes out into the real world. Other people recognize him as real and take him into account. He affects other people and events. He does things and changes things, and they are different afterwards. I stay in my imaginary world in this house, doing jobs that I largely invent and that no one cares about but myself. I do not change things. The work I do changes nothing. What I cook disappears. What I clean one day must be cleaned again the next. I seem to be involved in some sort of mysterious process rather than actions that have results. The only time that I think I might be real in myself is when I hear myself screaming or having hysterics. But it is at these times that I am in the most danger of being told that I am wrong or that I'm really not like what I'm acting like, or that he hates me. If he stops loving me, I'm sunk. I won't have any purpose in life or be sure I exist anymore. I must efface myself in order to avoid this and not make any demands on him or do anything that might offend him. I feel dead now, but if he stops loving me, I am really dead because I am nothing by myself. All right, that's the main thing that I'm concerned with. I feel that women can't take care of what's out there until they realize that they're all right, that what they've done in many cases to have a sense of not being okay is internalized things from out there. And that's what I think has happened in the last case. An equation that's been developed in radical psychiatry, I feel, is really important, and I think it should be explained to women in groups. Do you hold it? Mm-hmm. It really helps to have a woman up here to make me feel okay. No. Dottie is a very fine woman, really together. Lady here. I think that oppression plus mystification equals alienation, and I'd like to explain what I mean by that. I think that alienation is being out of tune with your world, not really feeling a part of it, and feeling that the reason you're not in tune with it is because you're not okay. There's something wrong with you. You somehow don't fit in. Lang in the Politics of Experience. No one can begin to think, feel, or act now except from the starting point of his or her own alienation. And he says, humanity is estranged from its authentic possibilities. And alienation is our present destiny, is achieved only by outrageous violence perpetrated by human beings on human beings. One of the biggest things that strikes me about how women experience alienation in their everyday lives, I think there are many ways that women feel alienated, but the one that really pushes my buttons is the one that makes them feel sexually alienated from themselves, or alienated from their own sexuality. And I feel that this is pretty frightening, because people like Marcuse, who talk about here's a good book, The 40 and Left, by Paul Robinson. He talks about Reich and Marcuse. Marcuse believes that one really can have a healthy consciousness if one doesn't have a healthy sexuality. And a recent survey in Psychology Today, which is a very select audience. I mean, this is reporting on, I think, middle, upper-class people, pretty enlightened, pretty sexually free, asking women how often they reach orgasm in an intercourse. 20%, almost never and never. 10%, about one-fourth of the time. Now, that's a pretty select report, and that's pretty scary, 30%, a quarter or less of the time. I think a lot should be worked on in these different areas. I mean, a lot of different points of alienation. But when a woman goes to a psychoanalyst and says, I'm not having an orgasm, and he's a Freudian and says, well, you know, penis envy, ha-ha, you know. I think a lot of things have to be changed. I won't get into that too much. But there are a lot of different ways women experience alienation. The bitchy menopausal female, all the different downers. And a woman who's alienated from her sexuality is really made to feel not okay, and that's what I mean about alienation. She's told she's frigid, you know. It's not that society doesn't have it together about where women are at sexually. No, no, it's not that. You're frigid, you know, something's wrong with you, you know. If we can dig out your frigid button, maybe we'll make you better, you know. And let's see, the other thing is, I think oppression is pretty clear, and mystification is deception, simply, it's deception. And, let's see, mystification in this equation is that if you're oppressed and then deceived about your oppression, then you feel alienated, you feel something's wrong with you. If there was no mystification, and it was just blatant oppression, you wouldn't feel so alienated, I think. I think you'd be in a position to overcome the oppression. And Lang says something about mystification. Human beings seem to have an almost unlimited capacity to deceive themselves and to deceive themselves into taking their own lies for truth. By such mystification, we achieve and sustain our adjustment, adaptation, and socialization. And from that, talking about when mystification is gone, Marx says in the early writings of the 1844 manuscripts, the call to abandon their illusions about their condition is a call to abandon a condition which requires illusions. And the opposite of that, which we hope to do in radical psychology, psychiatry, is to change it around. And that's through awareness and contact to achieve liberation. And I think that they're pretty straightforward. Liberation is freedom, and awareness is consciousness. But consciousness alone, awareness, and knowing that you're being oppressed and that you really are right is not enough, I think, to move you to really being an adequate agent, you know, in the world. I think that also to move you, I mean, awareness, just getting awareness, I think, is like psychoanalysis. It's just like being analyzed. You might know all the things that are wrong, but you might not be able to make those steps that will make your life good. And I think that what moves people is contact. And contact, I think, is of two kinds. I think it's very important that there be contact in the group situation. And contact involves physical and whatever kinds of strokes and group support. I don't know if people know what strokes are. Stroke is a form of human recognition. It can be, it's best if it's positive. It can be a compliment, a hug, a smile, whatever. Let's see. I also, there's another thing that I'd like to throw in here. I think that along with contact in the group situation with other women, women should also have the option of being able to come up against men or contact men as at least equals, and not to feel intimidated or inadequate or incapable of arguing or whatever. And I think that they should have the support of sisters in the group and friends to do that. Let's see. As I was saying, I feel that, you know, that oppression is out there and it's in here. And I think what happens is that at a very early age, we start to internalize the downers that people put on us, all the things they say to us to make us feel not quite right. And I guess I should explain the structural analysis thing that Byrne worked out so that it makes sense. He divided people up, of the ego, into three observable states, the parent, the adult, and the child. The parent is the part of the personality or part that you see that seems to have all the answers, knows what's right and wrong and what to do and all that. And the adult is a computer-like consciousness that takes in and processes information and makes predictions. And the child is the creative, direct part that likes to play and likes to do things and has a lot of fun. I think what happens is that Byrne generally, in talking about the parent, just talked about what we internalize from our parents. But I think that there's more than that. I think that we internalize a lot from society. And especially women internalize a lot that makes them feel that they're not quite good enough, or not quite as good as men in some ways. And I think that you can make this pretty obvious to people. We talked about bragging in this class before, a technique for making people aware of that oppression inside them. Little kids are pretty happy to tell you how groovy they are. You know, they think they want you to know how wonderful they are, and they don't feel inhibited about feeling groovy. And usually grown-ups start telling them that they're not all that groovy and that maybe they should be a little humble and, you know, all that. So that plus a lot of other things where, Daddy tells Janie to be a nice little girl and wear a frilly dress and sit on his lap and not be too smart when you grow up, and I don't think you want to be a doctor, I think you want to be a nurse. That's the what I call a pig parent, or the parental oppression. And I think this is one of the biggest things that brings women down. The biggest thing that brings women down is out there. But I think within themselves, this is what does them the most damage. They definitely can get a sense of not being all right. And I think to counteract that, what they have to do is really commission the adult to have solid responses, adult responses, for when the parent, I should go back a little bit. In the bragging thing, you can really, when you're really being fine, when you're really being fancy, you can sometimes pick up not feeling too good about yourself, or start suddenly feeling scared or sad. And if you really tune into it, I think you can start to hear a voice. You can start to hear you say something good about yourself, and the voice says, "Ah, I'm not that good," or something like that. And you can really get in touch with the bad things that your parent voice might be saying to you. Well, anyway, you can get in touch with these things, and the techniques that I've been experimenting with to get rid of it, the downers, is to try to hear the parent, what it says to you about, oh, you're not that good, or you're not that nice to be around, or whatever. And maybe even write them down and work out good adult responses for them that say, come on, that's a bunch of crap, you know that I'm blah, 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 whatever. And also to commission the nurturing parent, which everybody has in them, but it's usually there for everybody else but yourself, you know, because you don't have permission to be nice and love yourself. You can have a modicum of it, you know, so you don't starve to death and you brush your teeth maybe, but that really loving, nurturing parent is usually there, especially in women, for children or men or whoever, but not for themselves. And you try to commission that self-love, that tenderness for yourself, to take care of your child, to take your child and kind of offset this and eventually hope to get rid of it. Well, let's see. Okay, a couple of other things that I think are really important in women's groups is permission and protection. The leader can assume, usually in group, the leader will be, the transactions will be adult to adult. But in a permission transaction, the leader can assume parental potency, and by that I mean counter the injunction that the original parent or society or whatever has given to the child, which is usually very strong, by giving a strong injunction to do something that the child doesn't have permission to do. And this can be pretty scary for the child, so at the same time giving permission to do something like permission to touch other women, which most people get parented not to have permission to do, you have to provide protection. You have to say, well, here's my phone number and the group's here to support you, and if you get scared, you know, we'll talk to you, we'll be there for you. And the stroke thing is really important when you get into permission. I think it's very important to give women permission to stroke each other. Stroking is the supply and demand thing on strokes. It's like sex. It's like all the goodies in the world. Capitalism is, you know, convinced us that there's a short supply of it, but there really aren't. I mean, there's plenty of goodies to go around. So what you have to do is give permission so that people know that. And strokes, you know, the way they've been set up in our society, I think mostly we're told that they have sexual connotations, but that's not true. Or maybe they have erotic connotations. I mean, I'm not saying, oh, well, you know, some Baptist thing is clean, you know, don't worry, you know. No, I mean, they might be sexy, you know, but the thing is, it's okay. And I think that it gets women, you know, get stroke starved because there's such a limitation. It has to be from the right guy in the right circumstances and everything. But women should feel free to get strokes, hugs, whatever, you know, from other women. And this will also counter all the, the whole divide and conquer thing, you know, how blacks fight among themselves. Well, women have always fought among themselves to a certain degree, you know, man enters the room and have to compete. And it's just a thing of getting a group to be very supportive to one another and to really develop a sense of sisterhood and give women permission to really dig on other women, because I don't think women can really dig on themselves unless they can look at another woman and say, gee, you know, she's really groovy, you know. That's very important, I think. Other permission exercises that can be done in group are trust exercises and the bragging and things like that. You can start out when you're doing exercises to give people permission to stroke each other, just start out giving verbal strokes. And a verbal stroke should be really honest, really straight, saying something you like about somebody else. And then go into, you know, giving permission to give physical strokes. Anyway. One thing I like to throw in that I've thought about, for women who feel that they want to be in a mixed group and who have boyfriends or whatever that they'd like to be with them, or just be with strange men, but anyway, feel like they'd like to be in a situation with men, I think one model that might work out is to have, say, six men and six women come together in a group and do the regular contractual group thing, and then meet again separately where the women meet and they can get it together about whatever they think is going down in a chauvinist way or whatever, and the men can talk and also develop this thing of brotherhood. My concern is sisterhood, but I think men are being really cheated. Yeah. I mean, women don't have permission to touch, but I have a hell of a lot more permission to touch than men do, you know. And
that's changing.
Yeah, hopefully.
Not men.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. Let's see. Oh, another thing I think is really important that these groups be made viable for all women and all levels of consciousness, not just 10% that might be involved in women's liberation, but it should be made a viable alternative for married women, whoever would be interested. And this is a good book, The Women Question. And in here, Lenin says, it has been observed in the experience of all liberation movements that the success of a revolution depends on the extent to which women take part in it. And I think if the world is going to be free, women are going to have to be free. And another thing I'd like to stress for women who are interested in leading groups to really try to set up a feeling of cooperation, not competition, to stress the positive, not the negative, and really try to develop a sense of loving tolerance for one woman for another. And that just involves not expecting, that's what the pig parent does, is expects perfection and demands some kind of superhuman qualities. I think you have to get women to greet each other in a sympathetic way and realize that they're human beings, they're not, you know, superhuman. And And with things like the trust exercises and stuff, you can develop a sense of group love and sisterhood.
Hey.